This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas, having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning. That's a wonderful smile you have, Eric.
I'm very happy today.
Well, good.
Almost every day.
Good. It's nice to see everyone, be back here. I was reflecting on some words that I read recently by Uchiyama Roshi, who is no longer with us, but in the translation of one of his books, he said that before sesshin, which is usually a week-long period of meditation, he gets really anxious and like butterflies in his stomach, and he just panics. But then when he gets to sesshin, it feels like normal life. And I think that coming here to give a Dharma talk, I think, well, what am I going to say? And I'm not going to remember even if I write it down. And will I meet everyone's needs? And then all of a sudden I'm here and it all seems okay. And I think it's kind of a reflection of what our practice is, that we're not practicing to become perfect beings. We already are Buddhas, so to speak, and our practice is basically, as Koban has said, is to accept ourselves. And it's probably one of the most difficult things to do. And when we sit, that's exactly what we're doing. There's a term that's that Dogen used, Jijuyu's Zamai, which is, some people say it's self-fulfilling samadhi. I like to think of it as self-receiving samadhi. So that when you're sitting, you're receiving yourself. Again, moment after moment after moment. And that's a way of, the receiving is a way of accepting yourself. Mayazumi Roshi used to refer to it as appreciating oneself. I don't think a talk went by where he didn't say, just appreciate yourself. And so when we sit, sometimes our minds are like a still lake, and sometimes they're like a raging ocean. But we sit, we keep sitting, and not reject one and think that the other is great. I've heard people say, oh, you know, I'm sitting and all of a sudden my mind is feeling, it like drops off, or however they explain it. And but as soon as I notice it, then everything comes back. So we can't hold on to that anything, whether it's something that we think is so-called positive, and we don't hold on to anything that's negative, and we don't judge it. don't judge it in ourselves. And I think if we can be that way with ourselves, then there's more of a chance that we'll be that way with others. I remember when I was, I don't know whether I was in high school or college, maybe college, there's a book by Eric Fromm. Maybe some of you who are old enough remember it, called The Art of Loving. And it's always stuck with me is that in order to love other people, you have to love yourself. And I think that's basically what we're doing here. We're moment after moment, we're loving and appreciating ourselves. And each one of us sees the world from our own perspective. We think that we're all seeing the same thing, but probably we're not. But that's our sort of our tendency, that we're all perceiving everything in the same way. And it's like when we come into the world is born with us, and then we live with the world that we encounter. And everything that we encounter becomes our world. And then when we die, our world dies with us. And I think practice is more and more when we encounter things in our world to see those things as ourselves, to recognize, like, all of you are my world. And then, like, we're all, I don't know, this maybe little knots on a net or little bubbles on a net, and we're all perceiving each other. And it's kind of, I don't want to think about it too much because it makes me dizzy. I remember Coben once saying, when you're practicing, it's like being on a train and you look out the window and everything looks fine, but if you look down at the tracks, you get really dizzy. And so in some ways, just our sitting is enough without lots of explanations about it. I think some of you are probably new to Jikoji, and some of you I've known forever. And I actually lived up here when this place first became Jikoji. And I think that was in 1979, which is almost 40 years ago. And before that, it was a high school called Pacific High School, which, have anyone here associated with Pacific High School? I don't think so.
Yeah.
Oh, you were? Oh, were you a teacher here?
I was a biology teacher here.
Uh huh.
And some of the students from here, and then I went to teaching at the Stanford Education Department.
Uh huh.
And some of my, two of my students from here were students of mine over there.
Ah.
Okay. Long time ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. And I was reading a little bit about the history, and I think it started, Pacific High School started in 1965, and it was a real hippie school. I think the Wavy Gravy made his way up here, and some of the other merry pranksters. And what I didn't realize, though, before Pacific High School came up here, when they were down on the around Menlo Park, I think, in that area. They had a lot of different places where they, where the school resided. And one of those places was the Duvenick Ranch, which is where many of us did our sesshins with Coben. And I found that very interesting. Somehow our paths crossed again. And the way this place came to us is that Pacific High School wasn't going too well. I don't know what their problems were, but they had a big debt. And so Bodhi or Chikoji took over that debt and I think traded some land with the peninsula. I forget, what's the name of
the Peninsula Regional Open Space.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. And so then we became Chikoji, and gradually the school, people from the school left, as well as people who were living here as a community. And one of the reasons I mention this is because when we're sitting with not only our whole life, but we're sitting with everything. Way back, way in the future. It's not something that we necessarily perceive, but it's good to reflect on, I think, because it makes us understand more how we're not separate individuals, that we're all connected, and that none of us could exist without anyone or anything else. There are different causes and conditions of why things happen. A plant grows if the sun is shining and it gets watered. And the reason we're all in this room together is unfathomable. Each of us found our way up here for a myriad of reasons. And I think when we realize that interconnectedness, more and more we appreciate others, and treat others in a way that like we want to treat ourselves, we treat others. I think that there are what's called the six paramitas, and those are the perfections. And the first one is giving. And I think that practice of giving or generosity is very, very deeply embedded in our everyday life. And along with giving is receiving. Just like in Zazen, we're receiving ourselves. We're also giving. We're not sitting by ourselves, we're sitting with everyone, we're sitting with the whole world. And sometimes it's hard to actualize that. We get caught up in our own delusions, greed, anger, ignorance. But at other times we do realize it, and I think when we're out in the world, so to speak, I think others see that by our actions, the way we speak. A few weeks ago, I guess maybe it's already a few months ago, time passes so quickly, I went to pick my son up at the airport. And before I left, I took my car in to be serviced because I'm always concern that it's going to break down. It's 20 years old. And so the car was fine, drove over the hill, and I was left an hour early so that I could go to Japantown. And my car started shaking and stopping and sort of going, when I pulled off at the exit I was supposed to get at it. And so I tried not to panic, sort of semi-panicked, and found my way to a gas station where there was a guy with an auto shop. And he was wonderful. He was my life. He saved my life. He was just doing his job, but he took care of me so that David only had to wait a half hour for me at the airport. And I just felt so grateful. And I'm sure he wasn't thinking that he was giving, but it was such a wonderful act of giving. And I think in our everyday lives that's going on, and everything we do, every encounter. There are places where I like to shop because I feel like the people who are working there are so giving. When you walk in, they welcome you, and they remember you. And it's not just because they're being told to. I think it's really coming from the heart. And we notice when that doesn't happen. And I think as part of our practice, we can give, we can appreciate what they're doing. The job that, even though they're just doing their job, they're still giving of themselves, and I think through our practice we appreciate that more and more. I gave a talk many weeks ago at the Santa Cruz Zen Center, and I talked roughly about the same, similar subject, and of giving. And one of the people who was at the talk reflected and shared what happened to her once recently, where she had lost her address book. And I think in the front of it she had her name and phone number, and someone found it and called her. And it turned out it was a homeless person. I don't know how that was figured out. I guess he may have said that he didn't live any place. And how could they meet so he could give this back to her? And she felt a little odd about it, but they finally figured out where they could meet. And she put $20 in her pocket and went to meet him, and everything was fine. And she took out the $20 and said, here, have yourself a nice dinner. And he went, no, that would take it, what I wanted to do for you away. It wouldn't be, that's not what I did it for. And she was very moved by that. And actually, when she told that story, it brought tears to somebody's eyes. It's all around us. It's all these wonderful things. I always like to read a few quotes. I always think people say things better than I do. Lately, I've been reading Dogen's Uji, Being Time, or as Tom Wright calls it, living time, the living quick of time. And coincidentally, before I got that book, it's called Deepest Practice, Deepest Wisdom, and it's a translation of three of Dogen's fascicles, and one of them is Uji. And a few weeks ago, there was some free books at the Zen Center, and I picked up one of talks by Katagiri Roshi, and it was on the same subject, being time. And then a friend the other week recommended a novel called A Tale for the Time Being by Ruth Ozeki, mm-hmm. who is the priest, I think she's in the lineage of Suzuki Roshi. And I just finished reading that book. So I'm sort of immersed in this time thing, and I'm not sure I have it all figured out, but I'm trying. Any rate, I just thought this was, Dogen wrote this at the beginning, towards the beginning of it. And I think it relates to what I've been talking about. Learn to appreciate each and every grass, each and every circumstance. Strive to enable all these things to manifest in the deepest and fullest way. Viewing of things in this way is the first step of practice. It seems like it can be the only step. I think if that's all we do, it's pretty good. And then I'd like to read something that Coben said. Coben didn't write, not like Dogen. Actually, Dogen, I have it, something that Dogen said about himself. Which I found very interesting. I think it's in the Zui Monkey. One of my greatest faults is that as soon as I pick up a pen, my writing naturally becomes elaborate and florid. So those of us who have read Dogen can... if that's his worst fault, that's pretty good. So Coben didn't write. We have to write for him. A lot of publications we're putting out with his spoken word. And actually, these are some thoughts of his that were in response to a question that someone asked about why do we sit? And it was around 2001, and it was at Carolyn Atkinson's house, and a group of us, a small group of us, would get together with him, I think about once a month, and I think this was over the period of about a year. And so this was his response. We sit to make life meaningful. The significance of our life is not experienced in striving to create some perfect thing. We must simply start with accepting ourselves. Sitting brings us back to actually who and where we are. This can be painful. Self-acceptance is the hardest thing to do. If we can't accept ourselves, we are living in ignorance. This darkest night, we may still be awake, but we don't know where we are. We cannot see. The mind has no light. Practice is this candle in our very darkest room.
When I asked Coben that same question, he looked at me, looked in my eyes and gave me a big smile and said, no purpose.
When I was thinking about reading this, I thought, he probably said something different every time someone asked him that question. And I think every teacher does that. Each moment is a new moment. There's no gap between the moments. They're all connected. But each one is new, and each one is a new opportunity for something. whatever that may be. And I know some of you are new to practice. It may even be your first time here. I don't know. I saw a few people who came in with Andy, so you must have been giving them Zazen instruction. Sitting is a wonderful way to start the day. Every day, that's how I start. And of course, I go to the bathroom, brush my teeth, and have a little something to eat. But it's hard for me to begin my day without doing Zazen. And I'm appreciating it more and more. I didn't think I could, but it grows on you. So I think I've said enough, even though I have all these little notes here, then with other things I could say. I think that's enough. So if anyone would like to make any comments, ask any questions. Yes?
Could you elaborate a little bit more on what it means to accept ourselves, and how are people not accepting of themselves?
That's a good question. I think that when we put ourselves down for doing something we shouldn't have done, we're not accepting ourselves. When we get angry, when we do anything that makes us not feel right, I think it's not accepting ourselves. And through sitting, it's a kind of mysterious in a way. But when we sit, it's just us. Okay, it's just this life, and there's nothing. We have to face who we are and be with that. And that willingness to be with oneself in that way, I think, helps us throughout our life, even when we're not doing Zazen, to have that kind of mind where if we stumble, it's okay. I remember once, many, many years ago, a long time ago, I was working with young children, infants and toddlers at a foundling hospital. And this little girl, she's probably under a year old, was standing in her crib and kind of laughing, and then she threw up. And she still had a smile on her face. But the caretaker kind of yelled at her. And as soon as that happened, the smile went away and her head went down. And I think that for probably all of us in growing up, things like that have happened. And so we don't feel so good about ourselves. And somehow, through sitting, we drop off those things. And if they come back, we can let them go more easily. Does that answer your question?
It does.
Thank you. Eric, did you have a question?
There's something that I've been thinking about those early days here with Colin. It keeps coming back to me, and I thought I would ask you and see what your sense of it was. He said to us one time here, and as regards to taking care of this place, don't turn the country into the city.
Don't turn the country into the city.
Yes. Did you have, do you have any response to that kind of thing? I mean, there are things on the surface, you know, don't turn this into a city, you know, like down in the flatland.
Right,
you know,
right.
Keep aware of the woods around here and be in touch with it and spend time outside and not just inside the four walls. But it was something that he said.
I think it's deeper than that. I think it's, yeah, I think it's more the mindset.
The pristine mindset.
Yeah.
The nature as it is, in other words.
I know I made the mistake of looking on the internet this morning and made me want to throw up.
I spent a lot of time.
Very embarrassing. Very embarrassing and disturbing. Huh?
I was just teasing you. I don't have a computer. I don't know how to use
it. Oh, you're smart. You're smart. I don't listen to the radio anymore, but I don't know. Somehow I'm going to have to break that habit too. But yeah, I think it's the competitiveness. You know, all the things that. It's like, what did Bob Dylan say? Leave your troubles at the door, you don't need them anymore. Something like that.
Yeah, that's a good thing about going out walking around here in the woods. Leave your troubles at home.
Right.
And don't take any back.
Yeah. You know, I go on and have a canyon right near my house. Beautiful walk, trees on either side, and lots of birds. And if something's bothering me, it helps a lot. Thank you, Eric. Elizabeth.
You reminded me some of your words when for Dinkaway, I was able to drop by for a few days. I was so excited because I don't get to do that very much. And I was sitting over there and I came in, I sat down and I stared at the floor. And all I could think was, what happened to the tatami? I just sat there and sat there and I started to get really, really angry. And I was surprised how angry I was. I left and I came back the next day and I sat down again in the same spot. And I was still really angry. I almost got up and walked out. But of course I just sat there and sat with it. One of the things that kept coming to me was one of the very first times I did Sesshin here was with Ellen Warburton. Mm. And she actually, during a talk, made a poem about the tatami. So I was very upset. But then I came again the next couple of days and it calmed down, the anger calmed down, and I realized she's still here and everyone else is still here. And so many memories in this space, even though every time I come it's a little different. And when you brought up the high school also, it still happens, but when we were living here, quite a few people every so often would pop up and, oh, I went to high school here. They would just drop by and show us around. And there was one guy who insisted on giving me a tour. So every spot, like, this is what I did, and look at this, and look at this, and we built this. And then he brought me in here, and he walked in and went, oh my God, what happened to this room? And then he looked up here, and he said, yeah.
It's the same.
And apparently, there were people who used to live up there.
Oh, wow. Then,
yeah.
So, sure, it's a loft.
Yeah. And he started crying at some point because one of the problems, I guess, with the high school was a lot of drugs toward the end.
Mm.
And one girl up there actually died. I don't think she was in there, but she lived up there, and that was her space. So I keep coming, and so many memories that are all still here. That's all I have to
say. Thank you, Elizabeth. I have a memory of you, I think, is giving Michael a massage outside the kitchen. Did she give you a massage? Do you remember that?
You owe me another one.
You were rubbing his shoulders. I, no matter how many changes take place here, I still feel, it still feels the same to me somehow. The outside of the buildings look the same. And even though there are all these changes in the Zendo, that the windows are the same and the trees are the same. And that's really important. But I know what you mean about change. Anyone else?
I'll be first, please.
Okay. Thanks. Jackie, right?
Yes, thanks. When you read the quote about appreciating all the grasses.
Yes.
That's extremely pertinent to me right now.
Right.
Because I've been weeding out all the non-native grasses from around here.
And have you been bowing to all of them?
I appreciate every single one. I do. And it brings up all these deep thoughts, you might say, and feelings about balance and, you know, just what am I doing here? And I'm lucky enough that my my daughter and her husband and their two kids live with us. And my granddaughter, who is six, was out in my garden, out in the property weeding. And Hazel came out to weed with me, and she's going, "I hate you, weeds. I hate you." And I was like, "Hazel, the weeds are just as nice as all the other plants, but they just don't belong here. Because," and there's various reasons why we would like to help the nature that evolved here to thrive here. And you go back to the high school. You can go back to the Spaniards that came here first with all of the grasses that are on the hill and the, all the changes that have happened in the ecosystem and the pointlessness in a way of trying to fight it because it's here, but yet wanting to create restoration areas or oases where we can appreciate the nature that evolved here, the nature that expressed itself here. And I'm not sure quite how that plays into the other thoughts, but I just bring it up because of that.
Yeah, it definitely does. It's definitely the connection there. I know Eric appreciates that. He can tell you a whole bunch of stories about the history of this land.
There's a very interesting diary, Jackie. From the 1880s, when Skyline came through here, it was built in 1860. So all of these properties along here were homesteaded at that time. And at the headwaters of Peters Creek here, the Pear Tree Spring, was the Faccio property. And Mrs. Faccio kept a diary about the goings-on around here at that time. And at one point, in the, you can go read the diary down at the Historical Society of Santa Clara County. And she wrote about the abundance of grizzlies here at that time. The acorns would come down, the grizzlies were all over the place, and how their meat was so bright red and just better than the best pork, and you know, how this this young family who had lived, was living here at that time, 1860, that they wouldn't have made it, perhaps without grizzly bear meat, a native
animal. So many things to consider. And just before I, and I have one book recommendation about time, which is Carlo Rovelli, The Structure of Time. Carlo Rovelli is a physicist, but he has something of a poetic mind as well. And when he communicates his view of the scientific understanding of time. Uh-huh. It really got through to me in a very different way, and uh-huh. in a way that I would love everybody to read that book, because it was so good for me. It might not be good for other people.
But, how do you spell his last name?
Rovelli, R-O-V-E-L-L-I. And okay. It's a fairly short book to read.
Okay,
he says
you
can skip two chapters that, you know,
okay.
if you don't want to get into the details.
Okay. Are you?
Thank you, Ellen. Beautiful talk.
Thank you.
My question isn't well thought out, but I wanted to ask something about the likes and dislikes.
About the likes and
dislikes. Likes and dislikes,
okay.
That a little bit related to Kieran's question about when people not accept themselves, because mm-hmm. I do see, especially when we are in practice, a lot of people are approaching things with simply, I like this, or I don't like this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after mm-hmm. a sesshin or some other experience, the people that I often bring into practice and people I deeply care about, it's like I feel they've used kind of a shopping mindset,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the part of me get very frustrated. So, because there's something beneath the likes and dislikes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a deeper acceptance. But I know that's also just a part of me getting triggered, and that I want them to have a certain
mm-hmm.
experience, you know? So, I'm just curious. I'm sure that, you know, in Zen, how do you know, how do I work with myself in that situation?
Mm-hmm.
And how do I maybe support or help the people that I bring into practice to go to that deep
mm-hmm.
acceptance of
mm-hmm.
oneself? Is it just simply they have to feel pulled enough to sit on their own?
Hmm. The last thing that you said sort of shifted the whole thing for me. So you're talking about encouraging people to sit, and
mm-hmm. Yeah, I think sometimes after these experiences, if my friends, my loved ones say, if I can see that their mind is simply like going through, like there are certain things I like, there are certain things I don't like.
Oh, okay.
What do I do, basically? You
right,
know,
right.
And I realize a part of me does not like that. So there's things
mm-hmm.
for me to
right,
work with as
right.
well, right? But if, you know, do I simply let it be? Like, you know, they're going to choose on their own whether or not to continue practice or not.
Well, I guess they will.
Yeah.
I mean, I know a friend of mine, sort of a friend, someone that I knew because she was in the class that I was teaching, an infant toddler class. And so we knew each other that way. And then we met recently at the store and said, oh, you know, nice to see you. Let's get together because we live near each other. And she knew nothing about my life. And I told her, I said, well, I can't get together with you next week because I'm going on a retreat. And she says, oh, what are you going to do? And I told her, and you know, she sort of went, you know, like, that's weird. I mean, she didn't say that. And then afterwards we got together and she asked me to tell her about the retreat. And so I explained it. And she says, you know, oh, that's interesting. But somehow I feel like she may not call me again. I don't, it's, yeah. I think people come to it on their own. I know the first time I sat was with my Tai Chi teacher. And actually, it wasn't exactly with her. She, at the end of class, she suggested when she was going to teach her beginning class that her advanced students sit in the next room. And I didn't want to do that. But then eventually I did it. And thought, it's kind of interesting. And then I sat at home, and somehow it just resonated with me. And soon after that, I moved to Santa Cruz and met Coben. You know, causes and conditions. And, yeah. Does that help?
Yes, I think if I, maybe there are also situations where people have come to say to Jikoji, right, and said a sesshin or, you know, said a zazen kai. Uh-huh. And then the way they're reflecting on it, I can see is mostly from the lens of likes and dislikes, rather than the acceptance that you have been uh-huh. talking about today.
Oh,
okay. And it's, my question is, like, especially if I brought them here, right, like, I feel a little bit of responsibility to, like, support them or help them in some way. Do
yeah.
I say anything? Or do I say there's a deeper level to this? Or do I let it go?
I don't know. Michael.
Just
yeah.
if I could.
Please.
Yeah.
Please.
In our current modern life, so much things just come to us. You know, we have all this media and the website, and there's a certain, I would call it like a cultural laxity, where we expect things to be delivered to us or come to us. And meditation is, I think when advising people that are new to meditation, to remind them that this isn't something where you just, like turning on a television or something, where you just get something, something comes to you.
It's
actually, it's work. This is actually work.
Mm.
This is karma yoga, which is the yoga that, or the discipline of activity. Even though we're just sitting still and we're being quiet, it's actually, we can
mm-hmm.
speak to this who practice for a long time. It's
mm-hmm.
hard. It's hard work.
Oh yeah.
And to
yeah.
emphasize to new people that it isn't just sitting down and getting
yeah.
A package or anything, but it's going to work.
Can I add
yes.
something? Just from my understanding of acceptance, I think I know where you're coming from, Ying. And I think that like when we invite people to experience something which is good, and then they don't get it, and then we are not okay with it because they didn't get it, and we are. And then we're like, okay, why am I not okay with
mm-hmm.
they not getting it?
Mm-hmm.
But I think like what we learned in this talk is to accept that we are not okay with they not getting it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Oh, yes.
I was thinking you were talking about gratitude. How do you be grateful? Because I feel like what we hear about gratitude is we hear about its importance, and we hear just kind of these vague affirmations of, we talk about it as like, oh, we should do that, you know, like,
mm-hmm.
oh, remember to stay grateful, be grateful.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, that's, it's not, I don't find that very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like a nice thought, and they're like, yeah, yeah, I need to be more grateful. Then it like nothing happens. Doesn't do.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
well, if we have to think that we have to be grateful, then there's no point in it.
I think. It's kind of like, how do you even approach the whole project of being more grateful if thinking
yeah.
it, you're already screwed, right? If you're thinking it, like you said. But it's like short of like keeping a gratitude journal, it's
mm.
the only thing I can think of. So it's like, if I want to be more grateful,
mm.
even like say for something specific in my daily life.
Mm-hmm.
What does like Zen have to tell us about how to do that? Or do you have any thoughts on like how to actually become more grateful as opposed
mm-hmm.
to just talk about it? Yeah.
Well, there, you know, some people do that as a practice to be grateful for things. Actually, in Zen practice, there are chants that one does before one eats. Showing gratitude for the food and for all the people who labored to bring us this food. There's a little chant for when you take a shower.
We have that in the bathroom.
There's a chant even, which I didn't know, for going to the toilet. I read that in that tale for the time being. Grateful for everything. So I think when we bow during service, it's a kind of gratitude. It's giving up of ourselves. And I think when we sit, it opens the heart. And when the heart is opened, it's a natural feeling. And so, like the story that I told about the mechanic, I wasn't thinking, oh, I'm so grateful. I was just feeling this deep sense of, he just made my life so much easier. And felt wonderful. Does that help at all?
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you. Andy?
What I was reminded by with Kisi's question is one of Vanya's good friends, Vanya, the kind of head of our lineage, is Brother David Standelrost, and he's really big into a gratefulness and gratitude as a practice. And what he said is that, like, with a lot of times with meditation, is a kind of interview that I've heard of his, that some people may not see or recognize, like, quote-unquote results of a meditation practice or sitting practice right away. It's not what we're always looking for, but it may not be evident. But in a gratefulness practice, you may start in the morning, and by noon you start to feel something quite often. And the way he kind of recommends doing it is just like finding one thing you can be grateful for and then kind of expanding it and staying with it for a little while and really feeling that appreciation and letting it permeate. And I've tried it for given periods of times. It's one of the most powerful things I've ever done.
Mm.
It's incredible. And sometimes while I'm driving, I'm doing that. Like, I might speak it aloud, or sometimes I keep an audio journal, like, just with my thoughts, because I do a lot of driving, living up here and driving to town. I'm like, journal. June 18th, 2018. And, I started doing that after watching Twin Peaks, and Dale Cooper would always have his journal, and he'd be speaking into it. And so I started doing this, and I'm just like, I'm really feeling grateful for my mom, or whatever it is. And then I start, and then then it grows and it grows. And by the time I get into town, I'm just gushing. So it's, you don't always know, but, what's going to happen, but that's one way it's worked for me, and I've been inspired by Brother David.
That's cool.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful person.
He is.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Andy.
Yeah.
So I think we should end.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.